John, thank you so much for speaking with me. We're talking on the occasion of your being presented with the Brooklyn Book Festival's Bobby Award, which I gather stands for Best of Brooklyn. I know you taught there at one time, and also that W.H. Auden, an important figure in your life, lived there. Would you say that Brooklyn has a distinct character and that it's important for it to have its own literary territory?
Well, I think it does, certainly today, with the many fiction writers who live there, but as you point out, and Auden lived there, as did Paul Bowles and Jane Bowles. I believe they lived in the same house. And, of course, Marianne Moore is almost synonymous with Brooklyn. In fact, she has a line somewhere that goes, "Something in Brooklyn makes me feel at home."
I think that's very much what they're hoping. When you taught there, was it mostly Brooklyn residents, or did lots of people come in from the rest of the city to work with you as well?
Well, I taught at the MFA program, which was just beginning at that time, and it didn't draw students from outside because it hadn't yet become known, but now it's quite different. I think it's one of the well-known programs of its type in the country and gets students from all over.
I'm sure you helped with that. Now, this is one of a long line of honors in a fairly triumphant progress through an artist's life. I get the sense, looking at material about you, that people have a way of treating you emblematically as if you were part of a culture in the past, in the way in which people talk about Milton and Shakespeare and Dante and Auden and Eliot. Is it difficult to be present at that much active debate when you're still in the middle of your own life?
Well, it's strange because I had the good fortune to receive a bunch of literary prizes when I was about 40, and which kind of institutionalized me. Yet at the same time, the jury was and remains out on the actual importance of my work. So, on the one hand, I'm accepted and canonized, and on the other, things aren't quite yet settled, which I guess is the way it ought to be.
One of the things I found odd is that both camps cite you in support of their opinions. If you were one of these people, how would you characterize yourself?
If I was one of which people?
Somebody pronouncing on the work of John Ashbery. How would you characterize yourself?
I think, characterize myself as somebody who has always tried to experiment in my writing, and yet at the same time tried to keep the experiment in check so that my work would still be recognizable as poetry as we know it.
Thank you. You mentioned in one interview that your writing was a kind of mystery when you begin. What does happen? Do you start with a word or an image? Does it vary depending on the poem?
Usually I start with a few lines or thoughts that have occurred to me recently, maybe an ordinary phrase that somehow seems not so ordinary and seems to go deep into the sort of magma of my thinking. And in sort of toying with these words and phrases and thinking about what has been happening to me and looking out of the window, I start to write and something gets written.
Is that what you meant by an everyday frame of mind, which is another way you described this process once?
I suppose it could be that, yes. Mm-hmm.
I found myself, again, returning to this idea that some people have called you a little bit inaccessible, I found myself really liking the voice I heard in many of these pieces, somebody who seemed to be keen to let us in on the secret, you know, banish the truth, that's the whole point, goes one line, and you can go over all kinds of old feelings, throw some away, keep others, or the poem has set me down softly beside you, the poem is you. Are you aware of creating a person, someone who's talking to us when you do this?
I wouldn't say that so much, but I am really imagining a reader when I'm writing and trying to say something that will have some meaning for that potential person. My poetry is often criticized as inaccessible and private, but I think that's because I am trying to describe the privacy of all of us that that we all feel as individuals, and trying to make it not matter so much.
That seems both an enormous task and a consoling one in some ways. This is not a country that's widely sympathetic to immaterial jobs. Would you say that poetry is a job, has an obligation? That's the old question. You mentioned crashing the gate as one function, which I rather liked.
I don't think that poetry has a job or that one should try to crash the gate. I don't remember exactly where I said that. I think that the value of poetry is precisely that it doesn't have a purpose or a function, and it's something that it's there to be enjoyed.
When you came of age as a poet, it was fairly shortly after a devastating war, and you mentioned in a number of pieces a sense of exhaustion that you felt in some writers as a result of that, and nevertheless an amazing cadre of people came out of that period. What would you say about today? Is this a more difficult time for emerging writers, a more promising time?
Well, it's a more promising time since there is today a vast audience for poetry, despite the general impression that people have. At least that's what I think. When I was starting to write, there was really only one poetry magazine, which was Poetry Magazine. And I think poets were a very small and unknown segment of the writing population. Although at the same time, it was a period of tremendous richness in poetry that is quite neglected today. I think American poetry of the 1930s and 40s is a tremendously rich and unknown field that ought to be examined more closely. But today, the problem may be that there are too many poets competing for the exponentially increasing audience,
mm-hmm.
which somehow also takes place in a parallel universe that the general reading public may not be too familiar with.
One of the things that's very noticeable in the lineup for the Brooklyn Book Festival is the terrific diversity of voices, many, many more cultures represented, people from every corner of the globe. Is that something you have noticed changing and evolving over time?
Oh, yes. That's something that didn't exist very much when I began as a writer. There were, Richard Wright and Ralph Ellison were rarities at that time, and the cultural diversity that is everywhere today just wasn't there then.
So that's one good thing.
Yes.
Would you say that there is any subject to which poetry is fundamentally unsuited?
I hope not. I have, in writing, tried to find as many unsuitable subjects and topics as possible and to kind of drag them kicking and screaming into poetry. It's a question of merely thinking about what one shouldn't write poetry about and then going ahead and doing it. I wrote one poem, for instance, when it occurred to me one day that nobody, to my knowledge, had ever written a poem on the very important subject of the first movie they ever saw. So I then wrote that poem.
That's a great topic. What was it?
It was a movie of Alice in Wonderland, not the Disney, but before that in the 30s, a live movie, which isn't very well known, although it, interestingly, has just been released on home video for the first time.
And I remember when you received an award from Harvard a number of years ago, they actually interviewed you about films that you had been influenced by and loved very much.
Oh, at the Harvard Film Archive.
Yes. What are you working on now?
Just writing more poems. That's what I do. I accumulate poems, and then when it seems there might be enough for a book, I put them together and hope that it will be published.
So you just wait for things to have a kind of critical mass.
That's right, yes. I don't set out with a plan for a book in mind, for instance. It would be much easier if I did, but I don't.
Well, I know that at one time you were an art critic, and I get the sense that painters work much the same way. Their galleries are leaning on them for shows, but they just have to think about one painting at a time.
Yes, that's true.
Do you feel able to read something for me?
Oh, sure.
All right, whenever you're ready, John.
I'll read Paradoxes and Oxymorons, which is the earlier of the two poems. Paradoxes and Oxymorons. This poem is concerned with language on a very plain level. Look at it talking to you. You look out a window or pretend to fidget. You have it, but you don't have it. You miss it. It misses you. You miss each other. The poem is sad because it wants to be yours and cannot. What's a plain level? It is that and other things, bringing a system of them into play. Play, well, actually, yes, but I consider play to be a deeper outside thing, a dreamed role pattern, as in the division of grace, these long August days without proof, open-ended. And before you know it, it gets lost in the steam and chatter of typewriters. It has been played once more. I think you exist only to tease me into doing it on your level, and then you aren't there, or have adopted a different attitude. And the poem has set me softly down beside you. The poem is you. And this is a much more recent poem, Anticipated Stranger. The bruise will stop by later. For now, pain pauses in its round, notes the time of day, the patient's temperature, leaves a memo for the surrogate. What the hell did you think you were doing? I mean, oh well, less said the better, they all say. I'll post this at the desk. God will find the pattern and break it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.